How to know what Janet Yellen is thinking? How about you listen to her when she speaks? Pretty easy, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 6th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Perhaps I flatter myself, but I like to think that Janet Yellen is a listener to this radio program. And as such, she has surely heard of our every now and then game show called What is Janet Yellen Thinking? I mention that because Dr. Yellen gave a speech today full of the requisite Fed-speak caveats about when or if interest rates might rise. Someday is the answer. June is their next meeting. As always happens, though, the good stuff came during the Q&A when somebody almost literally asked, so, what are you going to do about interest rates?
I know market participants really want to know exactly what's going to happen. And it is only on rare occasions when we're able to provide that kind of guidance. There is, as I said, about 18 times no preset plan.
At least 18 times by my count. And okay, fine, I get it. No offense taken. Can't blame a guy for trying. There was also this, though, in response to a question about extreme economic unease, shall we say, surrounding the presumptive Republican nominee for president. Here's that one.
Is this a possibility? Thank you.
An easy one. I'm sorry. I've got nothing for you on that.
Who said central bankers can't be diplomatic, huh? Secretary of State John Kerry and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew are in Beijing today, part of a big strategic economic dialogue the United States and China do every year. Lots of stuff on the table, of course. Financial markets, those islands in the South China Sea, and steel. Lots and lots of steel. Too much steel, by many accounts. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
China is producing so much steel and selling it so cheaply, other countries are getting pretty upset. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said today the excess capacity was damaging global markets, and he wants China to do more to stop it.
Implementing policies to substantially reduce production in a range of sectors suffering from overcapacity, including steel and aluminum, is critical to the function and stability of international markets.
This is a big deal because the cheap Chinese steel is undercutting prices in the U.S. and Europe, places where manufacturing is already struggling. David Dollar is a senior fellow at the China Center at the Brookings Institution.
I would argue it's the most important economic issue between China and the U.S. this year.
China is the world's number one steel producer, and millions of people are employed in the sector.
Their excess capacity is more than the number two steel producer in the world, Japan.
And that's just the excess. China doesn't want to put all of those people out of work too quickly, risking political instability. Sean Miner at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says China is working on the issue.
They are saying that they're going to reduce by about 10% their production over the next 5 years. Well, that timeline will have devastating effects on the U.S. steel industry and Europe's steel industry.
So the U.S. is pushing China to move faster and retaliating with higher tariffs on steel in the meantime. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
You remember how, after the financial crisis, investment banking as a career was supposed to have been so 2006, and that all the new college graduates were headed to Silicon Valley and tech jobs? The glamour jobs had changed coasts, as it were. Except it wasn't. According to the Financial Times, Goldman Sachs got more than a quarter of a million applications for this summer's 2,000 openings. Other Wall Street banks report similar trends as well. Gigi Duban has more now on why so many are so undeterred.
You'd think the 2008 banking industry meltdown would have left college students and grads with one gut instinct. Run. Run far away.
But in fact, it didn't, and students had an increasing interest in going in that direction.
That's Monica Buta, Director of Employer Relations at Johns Hopkins University's Career Center. She says engineering and IT jobs are still top destinations for students, but interest in investment banking there, she says, has been robust.
Very, very steady interest from students in careers in financial services, and particularly Wall Street.
She says for the past 5 years, firms like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and Citigroup have been among the school's top 10 employers. And they're selective employers, Citigroup says of its applicants, only 2.7% were hired.
They're really trying to actually attract that same top talent pool that Google has been so successful and Amazon so successful in attracting.
That's Mark Williams, professor of finance at Boston University. He says banks are doing that not only by paying well, as they always have, but also trying to make it less of a grind.
Today, I think the view is that, you know, you need to be compensated for the work hours, but also in particular, you need a lifestyle.
Better work-life balance is great, but Williams says the increase in interest might also just be a numbers game. Fewer banks and plenty of graduates still up for the challenge of making the big bucks. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
There was another oil train derailment last week. Oregon, this time. Flames, thick black smoke, forced evacuations from the nearby town of Mosier. It's a familiar pattern that's brought attention back to the dangers of transporting crude on the rails. There has been plenty of high-profile accidents involving oil trains and a push to try to make that kind of oil transport safer. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim reminds us where things stand on that.
It's not known yet what caused the train to derail, but this accident, along with others, has raised questions about the safety of oil by rail. One thing specifically, the tanker cars that are used to transport the oil. The ones involved in the accident were an upgraded model. Brett Vandenhoevel is executive director of Columbia Riverkeeper.
And that, frankly, makes me feel worse, that they're using the safest cars. They had just inspected the tracks and it still exploded.
Vandenhoevel's not exactly correct in saying the tankers were the safest cars out there. They are better than some older models, but there's a new model with thicker shells, heat shielding, improved valves. The DOT-117 is the new standard of transport for explosive liquids. But
very few of the 117 cars are in use at this time.
Robert Sumwalt is with the National Transportation Safety Board. He says those new cars will replace all older models by 2030.
We feel that this phase-in period is a bit long.
And he has reason to fear delays. The NTSB has long called for control measures designed to keep speeding trains from derailing. Congress recently extended the deadline for railroads to incorporate that to the end of 2018. But in Oregon today, some political leaders called for a temporary halt on oil trains through the gorge. Vandenhoevel of Columbia Riverkeeper wants that to go much longer.
We think that the only way to prevent oil trains from potentially, you know, devastating more communities is to prevent oil trains, period.
Trains are running, but a Union Pacific spokesman says it's not clear when oil shipments will resume. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Don't look now, but that whole global economic uncertainty thing got a boost this weekend after new polls showed rising support among British voters for the country to leave the European Union. The Brexit vote is June the 23rd, and nowhere in London is there more unease than in the city. That's capital T, capital C, the beating heart of British finance. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, popped up in London to present the UK with its annual economic forecast. The prospects? Pretty good, so long as Britain does not vote to leave the EU.
The consequences would be negative. Less consumption, less investment, higher prices, less jobs, so higher unemployment.
And she said London's status as a financial centre could be fatally undermined.
It's going to be pretty bad. To very, very bad.
Also anxious about Brexit is the Lloyd's insurance market, a pillar of London's financial centre for more than 300 years. The CEO, Inga Beale.
Potential departure from the EU is a fundamental threat to the Lloyd's market.
As Britain is in the EU, she says, Lloyd's can do business freely anywhere in the 28-nation bloc. Brexit would make matters much more difficult.
For Lloyd's, we would have to individually negotiate with each country how we could trade in that country. Very costly way of doing business.
Bankers worry too. Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan says he may cut 4,000 UK jobs if there's a Brexit. HSBC and Goldman Sachs also expressed alarm that Britain might be cutting itself off from its European markets. So could London lose its crown as Europe's financial capital? No chance, says pro-Brexit economist Gerard Lyons.
London will remain the financial centre of Europe. London's competition is no longer Frankfurt, Paris or Amsterdam as it used to be in the past. London's competition is New York, Singapore, Hong Kong.
And he claims London's preeminence is actually threatened by ever-encroaching EU regulation. Even some London investment bankers like Tarun Jotwani are not buying the doomsday scenario.
You think you might be shut out of financial markets to some extent in continental Europe if there is a Brexit?
I don't think so, because I think London is far too important. I think there's an adjustment, but I don't believe that shutting out happens.
He says he wouldn't pull out of London, though he might have to set up a subsidiary in continental Europe. And he remains very much opposed to Brexit.
Disruption can create unintended consequences, and that's what we are afraid of.
Disruption in one of the world's biggest financial centres, he says, is something the world, and that includes Britain, could do without. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We are just about at the end of presidential primary season, as you know. California and a bunch of other places are tomorrow. Puerto Rico was yesterday. Hillary Clinton won there. A lot of the talk on the island of late has been about how the federal government might best respond to its crippling debt crisis. Marketplace's Andy Euler spent a week on the island not too long ago. We talked to tons of Puerto Ricans and asked them exactly that question. Here's how Javier Alayon responded.
So the question is, how are things in Puerto Rico? It is like a coin. You have two sides. One side is tough, and the other side is happiness. I am just giving away my house to the bank because I cannot afford it anymore. Within a week and a couple of days, I have to be out of my house with my family. I guess it's a sad situation, but I'm still here today. I knew it was going to happen because I got laid off from my work about 5 years ago. They laid off my position, and I've been away from work for 2 years. Now I work for the government. I'm glad of that I'm working. But the salary is not the same. It's not that the government doesn't have any money. It's that usually when you work for the government, the pay is lower than in the private sector. So it's a huge difference in the payment. Yeah, it's tough, it's tough. It is tough. Where I was working, I was in the top management position, and we knew this was coming. I worked 5 years in the States. It is nice, the States is nice, but it's not the same. The sunlight in Puerto Rico is warmer. I love it. So I came back. When you are here, enjoying with your friends and the people and your culture and the music, you have to forget everything. You have to stay here, focus, enjoy, and then tomorrow, go back to reality.
Javier Alayon in Puerto Rico a couple of weeks ago talking politics and economics to our Andy Euler. We'll be right back. coming up.
I'm hoping to at least illuminate some of the issues and some of the complexity involved in Wall Street.
Art inspired by the financial crisis created by a guy who used to run a hedge fund. That's straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 113 points today, 0.6%, 17,920 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 26 points, about 0.5%, 49.68. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, 0.5%, 21.10 there. Financial firms like the sound of what Fed Chair Yellen was saying today. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 1%. Morgan Stanley advanced 1.1%. Oil prices hit their highest level in months, and energy stocks returned the favor. Marathon Oil shot up nearly 5%. Devon Energy gushed up 4.5%. T-Mobile pulled another one of its periodic stunts and said it would hand a share of stock to many of its customers, as well as free pizza and Frosties. No, I don't know what's up. Wall Street, however, not big on the handout, pushed the stock down 1.2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Take a one-time giant telecommunications company, some whiz-bang satellite technology, a shaky business plan, and a market literally the size of the planet, and you've either got a spectacular corporate failure, a really good story to tell, or maybe some combination of both. The company here is Motorola. The satellite technology is called Iridium. The planetary marketplace is cell phone coverage on every inch of the planet. John Bloom's book about it all is called Eccentric Orbits, The Iridium Story. John, it's good to talk to you.
Happy to be here.
I suppose we ought to start with some technical details here. The Iridium story. What is the Iridium system?
Iridium was the most complex satellite constellation ever put into space at a time when Motorola had decided that the answer to the world's use of cell phones would be to put the cell towers in the sky instead of trying to build cell towers 1 to 5 miles apart all across the whole world. And so they opened for business and nobody came. And then when their business plan didn't work out, they decided to just crash them into the ocean.
Which is cutting to the chase a little too fast. So let's back up for a minute.
Okay.
One of the things that comes through in this book is what a powerhouse Motorola used to be.
Yeah. Motorola was one of the most powerful companies in the world, and certainly probably the most powerful electronics company in the world. They were the only American company that was able to go up against the Japanese and win. And at the time that Iridium was created, they were looking for really the next generation of what Motorola could be. Motorola had invented the car radio. They had done most of the electronics infrastructure for everything that was ever launched into space. But they'd never owned a system like this, a communication system. So this was sort of the next step for Motorola. And it probably was the only place in the world that could have done something this complex at that time in history.
Well, the amazing thing is that, and even in like 2000 or something, cell phone coverage was only like 8% of the planet or something. I mean, the need for this, whether it's ocean voyages or whatever, was real.
Yeah. I mean, people think cell phones are usable in a much larger area than they are. Only about 14% of the Earth has cell phone coverage. The only phone that works on every inch of the planet is the Iridium phone.
Give me then the business proposition, because launching satellites is not cheap. The handsets for this thing were not cheap, and it was a big swallow for Motorola to try to get this thing going.
Well, we're talking about the early 90s. This was long before people thought that your cell phone would be a little computer that had data. They thought the only people who would be able to afford this, and really the only people who would want it, would be the international business traveler. That's what they called their target customer, the right. international business traveler. And they designed their whole business plan to appeal to this person. It completely failed. It was bankrupt within 9 months.
It was, you write, at the time, the biggest and the fastest bankruptcy we've ever seen.
Yeah, it was 1 year before Enron, so Enron kind of eclipsed it. But right. But at the time, yeah, it was the biggest bankruptcy ever.
A word about where Iridium is now. Obviously, they're still up there, and there are plans for a second generation, right?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, you know, when the Malaysian airliner went off the grid last year, people were sort of amazed, you know, how can an airliner disappear? But actually, that's happened many, many times in the past. That will no longer happen once the second generation of Iridium is in the skies, because the Arion system, which will be part of the new Iridium that's be launched later this year, it'll be fully operational in about 2 years, will finally track every airplane 24/7, 365, so nobody will ever leave the grid. So Iridium is continuing to do things that, you know, were previously impossible and will probably ensure its survival for decades to come, if not, you know, a couple more centuries.
The book by John Bloom, and it's a good one, is called Eccentric Orbits. It's about the Iridium satellite system and the phones that go along with it. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It is a good read, as I said. We've got an excerpt of it at marketplace.org. It's not unusual to hear hedge fund and art in the same sentence. I mean, it takes a lot of money to be able to buy a landmark piece, and hedge funders usually have a lot of money. The story we have here, though, is a little bit different, about a hedge fund manager who left Wall Street to make art, and not just as a hobby either. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story from New York.
We're witnessing the mirror image of a common street scene. We have a tow truck and a car, but instead of removing it from an illegal parking space, the truck is lowering it into place on the sidewalk in front of HG Contemporary, a gallery in New York's Chelsea neighborhood. It's a late model VW Beetle in black, but it's a little hard to tell because it's covered with multicolored graffiti, the work of Nelson Sayers, a former hedge fund manager.
The piece is called Arbitrage, about one of the strangest events I ever saw in finance.
People stop and gawk, but few seem to make the connection to finance until they read the work's description or lean in to hear Sayers explain. Some artists prefer not to explain their work. He loves to.
The domino imagery, this whole piece is about the beginning of the 2008 financial crisis.
Inside the gallery, we're in front of a rectangular canvas with a black background. It has large white dots on it, like a 2-4 pattern on a domino. But the dots have another meaning, tied to what happened on Wall Street in 2008.
It's actually Braille, and it spells out IG. Now, IG stands for investment grade. This piece really is about one of the main causes of 2008 was problems in the credit market, and in particular, investment grade securities, which maybe really weren't investment grade or AAA securities when the crisis began to happen.
Braille shows up in a lot of Sayers' recent work, reference to one of the problems that made the 2008 crisis as bad as it was.
Blindness by everybody. Blindness by investors, blindness by the rating agencies to the risk of the products they're rating, blindness by the regulators and the government to kind of modern finance into some of these products as well.
There have been books, documentaries, and plenty of marketplace stories digging into the complex causes of the crisis, but tackling this on canvas is something new.
I thought it was just extremely original.
Philippe Hurle-Guggenheim is the gallery's founder. He says most works in the recent show sold, grossing more than $200,000 altogether. The paintings, priced in the low five figures, tend to get the strongest response from people who hear Sayers talk through them.
Once you hear the concept, it just becomes even more intriguing. So you have a piece that's aesthetically beautiful, combined with the method and the concepts behind it, and it just becomes the perfect storm.
Sayers was successful enough as a trader that he was able to leave his hedge fund in 2014 to make art full-time. He didn't focus on Wall Street in his early works, though they did reference mathematical concepts that he also used trading derivatives. He says he's not going back to finance, but over the past few months, he found himself pulled towards saying something about the world he once worked in.
There's a lot going on, and I'm hoping to at least illuminate some of the issues and some of the complexity involved in Wall Street.
His paintings don't seem to take a side for or against Wall Street, but they definitely burrow deeply into its most misunderstood corners, finding hidden beauty and elegance in the mathematical concepts. In that way, they're doing something we often hope for in art, taking on a risky theme and creating something more engaging than anyone expected. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Should you be in the market, and honestly, even if you're not, you can see some of the art that Mark was talking about in a video at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today. You know how during negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the big trade deal that the Obama administration is trying to get through Congress, one of the big complaints from would-be opponents was that they weren't being allowed to read the thing as it was being negotiated. There's something else people won't be able to read for a while. Then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's emails about it. We learned today the State Department has blocked release of those emails until the end of November of this year. Timing, as always, is everything. Out of here we are. The Dow up 113 points today, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ up 26 points, 0.5% there. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, about 0.5% there as well. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.